Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Small Business Digest Radio. My name is Don Mazzella, and I am your host for a program devoted to identifying strategies and suggestions to help small business managers increase profits, add sales, better manage cash flow, improve employee management, and streamline operations. Our guests are other entrepreneurs and experts offering their solutions to the problems and opportunities facing small business leaders. Our aim in each program is to provide one or two thought-provoking ideas or suggestions. So follow us on Twitter at #2SBDigest or at our website at www.smallbusinessdigest.net. Thank you for listening tonight. All of our guests are invited.
Well, that's my engineer, that being me, hitting the wrong key. This is Don Mazzella. We're not closing the show. Rather, we're opening it with a very special guest tonight. I just met Mike Marzetta just 2 days ago, and I was so impressed with him that I invited him on the program. Mike is a serial entrepreneur and someone I think we all should listen to. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Don. How are you doing?
Well, we're doing fine now that we got that little hitch out of the way. Mike, we always ask our guests first to tell us a little bit about themselves personally and a little bit of their personal background before we get into anything else.
Let's see here. I'll give you the short or the long version. But I went to college at the University of Minnesota on wrestling scholarship and got my master's degree there in organization development and came back to work in the family business, which is a contract manufacturing company by the name of Altec, and we've got close to about 200 employees. Servicing medical, aerospace, high-tech industries. And then my passion a number of years ago, kind of prompted by a midlife crisis with my wife and I, decided to start a new company by the name of Mind's Eye to sort of give back. Our theme is to kind of make a difference and have fun doing it. It's kind of a robotics Legos on steroids, have you, really. High powerful, high technology stuff, and I guess that's about it.
Well, robotics is how I got to know you because, as you know, I'm on the board of the National Robotics Education Foundation, and our executive director thinks very highly of your products. What do you offer that? And I know it's interesting, but tell our audience what your Mind's Eye is about.
Well, what we tried to do, and it kind of started back a number of years ago at Altec when we had local kind of workforce shortages as far as the skilled labor gap is concerned. And that's also a national issue, like everybody knows, in most of the high-tech industries and clusters around the United States. And started getting involved with the high schools and the colleges and stuff like that, and just kind of found, kind of was left wanting in terms of the products that they have to choose from and the quality of those products, and able to give kids the skills that they really need in industry, the skills we were really looking for, not just the technical skills, but the what are called the 21st century skills, like teamwork, communication, critical thinking, stuff like that. And so we just decided to invent our own product to fill the gap, I suppose, for lack of a better term.
So what is your product?
Well, its base, it's kind of a flexible construction system. Kind of the foundation of it is, quick lock mechanisms that lock into place and are very strong and durable and light. And kind of you can kind of build anything that you can conceive, anything that you can picture in your mind's eye, you can bring it into reality, whether it's a robotic arm, a flying drone, or a Mars rover, or automated lawnmower, you name it. And then the extension of that is creating labs and curricula that teaches the teachers and gives the teachers and the kids a roadmap on how to apply it in the classroom. And that's the whole trick is, learning how to apply it in the classroom without losing your foothold in the world of industry in terms of where the application really takes place, and also without losing a foothold in the field of fun and excitement because, getting the kids jazzed up and passionate about it obviously improves the whole experience quite a bit.
Well, we're talking about, if correct me if I'm wrong, that in a lot of schools today, it's like kids build robots for competition or build robots for personal use and that sort of thing. Is that what we're talking about here? Or do you go beyond that?
Yeah. A lot of schools do their own robots, build their own kind of, I call it scratch build, or do something like First Robotics, which is, kind of mostly scratch-built robots and stuff like that. And if they're doing that, then, they've kind of graduated and, they're doing what we need them to do. But the greater bulk of the schools are out there that don't really have anything. And so our system is kind of a system that they can put in to get them going, so to speak, and give them some tools to work with and make it a little simpler and simplify the technology and bring it down to a level without losing the power of the technology, bring it down to a level that they can use and understand.
So if a teacher wants to utilize building something that like a robotic arm or to have the kids do it, that's where you come in. Am I right on that?
Correct, yeah. And not just build a robotic arm, but understand the science behind it. So if I'm doing a robotic arm, there's probably some servos and gear reducers in there that reduce the speed and increase the torque. There might be a sensor where it's detecting the presence of an object and thus telling the robot arm to pick up the object and do something with it and employing some autonomy. So it can be taken pretty far. It might coordinate with the second robotic arm or a conveyor belt and do some more sophisticated, complex tasks, so to speak.
Well, right now, there's a big movement to utilize robots or robotic applications in a lot of fields, including healthcare. Johnson & Johnson just teamed with Microsoft to do healthcare-related programs. Why is it important for young people to learn these critical skills?
Well, in my humble opinion, it kind of goes back to advanced manufacturing, and I would liken that to some of the products we do at Altec, where we're doing things like heart defibrillators and ultrasound machines and aerospace sensors and power supplies that, things like that pretty much have to work. Laser eye surgery equipment, there's not much room for mistake. And that's kind of in the realm of advanced manufacturing. And advanced manufacturing is really heavily tied in with the technology, the STEM education, the science, the technology, the engineering, math. You really have to understand the full composite of how those things work in order to be able to operate in that environment. and the things basically in the manufacturing world that aren't considered to be advanced manufacturing, you know, we're losing out those out to the rest of the world as far as the developing nations and stuff like that. If you're going to be doing garbage pails or something like that, you know, you can do those in Mexico or China or Indonesia or India just as well as you can do here. But if you're doing a heart defibrillator and that thing has to work, there's only one place you want to have that manufactured, and that's the United States.
And it's important because there just are not enough trained young people to fill the jobs that are becoming available.
Yeah, it's the skill gap. There's, you know, everybody's saying, well, unemployment's so high, how come you can't find any people? And it's a real challenge for everybody, and unemployment is still a bit high, and yet you need to have the 21st century skills to work in our kind of environment anyways that we have at Altec. There's just, you know, there's some entry-level positions, but ultimately what we're selling is knowledge. We're selling knowledge and we're selling confidence to the customer that our product is going to work, that they're buying at the best cost, that the design is robust. And to the degree that you're selling knowledge, your skilled force has to be a knowledge-based workforce, and if it doesn't require knowledge in order to do the job, then, you know, that's where the countries like China and India fit in, where they can manufacture that stuff just using, you know, low-skilled assembly labor and beat our pants off.
Well, you said that you and your wife, Cindy, co-founded a company and you wanted to give back. How are you giving back in this program, in these programs?
Well, just in terms of giving back, as we look at it, as my wife Christy and I, is just to trying to make a difference in the world and in our small way. And I try to do that in everything we do, in my job at Altec. And but, you know, hopefully this mind's eye system will take root in the education system, and teachers, students, administrators will kind of see a new vision about what education could be, and be able to kind of grow their programs from there. And so it sounded like a worthy cause.
Well, obviously, I think it is too, sitting on the floor. But now let's go a little further in the field. And you're considered one of the more knowledgeable people in robotics. Robotics education, but small businesses, we always use the figure that there are 250,000 unfilled jobs expected by the year 2017. But are there opportunities for small business in the robotics area?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a pretty broad definition of robotics, but or, you know, I would even include things like, you know, automated ERP systems and stuff like that, and automated accounting systems and order fulfillment and search engines. But certainly from old school robotics, any physical task that needs to be replicated or done very efficiently and accurately, there's always great fits for robotics. The whole CAD system, CAM system, part measurement, product measurement now is can be done robotically, and there just doesn't seem to be any substitute for it, at least in our industry. So a lot of the tolerances we're holding and the things we have to measure and validate and test, you know, really can't even be done without the aid of a robot in most of the cases.
Well, I like it that in Japan they're teaching robots to pick strawberries. I thought that was funny. But as someone pointed out to me earlier this week as well, robotics includes drones and drone-affiliated programs, et cetera.
Yeah, that seems to be the big the big buzz these days is around the drones, and it could be a world-changing phenomenon if some of the things that you see on TV that are kind of aimed to be a little bit futuristic might not be that many years away. Like, for instance, the Google driving car, for example, you're already seeing sort of evidence of some of the major automobile manufacturers starting to get certain fundamental foundational pieces, such as obstacle avoidance and collision avoidance and self-parking and a few things like that, that are building blocks to actually self-driving cars. And, you know, you've seen some of the things that Amazon's attempting to do around drone deliveries and stuff like that. And most of the technology is already there today. It's more of a socio-political challenge in terms of the technologies kind of outpacing what popular culture is still trying to figure out, what they can live with and what they can't live with when it comes to privacy and other things like that.
Well, you know, it was interesting. Just today, we got a. I also sit on the board of a medical marijuana company. talk about the. We just got a proposal for a robotic watering system. As you may or may not know, marijuana requires very constant. Growing marijuana requires constant and even distribution of light and water, which I didn't know before I got into the business. But we just got a proposal today, and when I looked, it was a small company. So, and I thought it was really appropriate that we were having you on tonight, because. To me, the real need is to make sure our young people have the skills to work in this area, and not only robotics but manufacturing. And I'd like to go back to your product, your offerings for a moment. And how do your offerings help them learn to think and to act and to be team players?
I don't know if the products in themselves, the products in themselves obviously help them to think in terms of it's a creation system at the at its base root, as it's a scattering of parts, microcontrollers, software, servos, motors, and I assemble all those pieces together using my intellect into making something do something. And so, that's obviously going to help improve their thinking skills to be exposed to that kind of technology and the ability just to adapt and to learn and to try different things. And then we try to do things in a interactive team environment. Most of our lesson plans and the things that they have to build and invent are done in a group of 3 to 5 kids. And so they can kind of leverage each other's strengths, and also, again, trying to mirror what industry likes to see and where some of the gap lies between the what the schools are presently teaching and what really happens in industry, because industry is so complex and intertwined. You can't just be an expert in one field. You also have to understand how your specific piece dovetails and interacts with everybody else's piece, and so thus teams are a prerequisite, and so it's not an option.
Well, you've been in business a relatively short time, but have you been able to measure the success of your teaching methods, and also how do you measure that, if you do?
I'm not a very traditional thinker. I mean, a lot of the measurements that I take are observations. You can observe the passion in the student. You can observe the excitement, the focus. You can see the team spirit, and the kids thinking and changing their mind and trying something new and experimenting and adapting. You can see them stay after school for 2 hours because they're so enthralled in their project that they can't leave home. They can't leave it to go home and play. And you see the products that they come up with and the challenges that they're solving. And that's to me, that's the evidence. You know, and most of it's qualitative. The school system, you know, likes to kind of make everything quantitative and passing tests and stuff, and that's important. But it's pretty tough to put a grade on somebody's creation. You know, almost grade it more like an art project, but also based on functionality. And those are the things I observe, and those are the things we're trying to encourage, I suppose. And the teachers are pretty pumped up too, so that's nice.
Well, you know, this is a generation. We're raising kids that are really much more tech savvy, certainly than I am, and they seem to be able to adapt to technology much better than older generations. Do you see that as an advantage?
Yeah, it's quite an advantage because you know, we service anywhere from the low of middle school to colleges. And it's kind of interesting when you're teaching new programming language. It's I would liken it to it's almost exactly like teaching a foreign language, because when you're writing code, you're actually writing sentences. You're using syntax or your letters and your commands, and you're writing sentences and paragraph that tells the robot exactly what you want it to do. And when you think about whether I want to start a kid off teaching him a foreign language, any foreign language, what's the best age to do that? You know, it's usually when they're pretty young. The younger, the better. And so, you know, we get questioned a lot. They're like, wow, you can teach this to middle school kids and this is still appropriate for college? And it's like, well, if they don't know the language yet, then they're actually kind of late in the game. You know, so yeah, we teach it to middle schools. We prefer to teach it to middle schools, but, you know, unless you guys already know it, this isn't something you can really skip over. And, you know, so it's the kids' brains at that age are significantly more malleable, you know, that they just are, you know, they don't have it filled up with the 25 years worth of information. They can just shift gears and learn something new significantly faster, it seems like programming, than can an older person. And I say older, I mean, you know, college age, which is young to guys like you and me. But
well, you know, again, the name of your company.
Mind's Eye Education.
And if people want to learn more about it, what's your website?
The website is mindsieeducation.com.
Repeat it again for our audience, please.
MINDSI education.com.
It's a very robust and interesting website. I went on it yesterday and I was just overwhelmed. It's really something. We always ask this of entrepreneurs. What are the three things that you've learned over the years that you would say are key to growth in a small business or any business?
Probably number one is just, you know, just continuous improvement. You always got to keep perfecting the formula and avoid complacency at all costs, and just question your assumptions and challenge your beliefs, and you know, learn new stuff every day, and that keeps you advancing ahead, hopefully at a rate that's at least equal to or faster than the rate of competition advancement, of course. And you know, probably another one would be the power of people, which took me a lot of years to figure out. And you know, as we're doing lean manufacturing and Six Sigma and all these things, and trying to drive them to some degree through the top and the leadership, and wondering why people aren't getting excited and enthralled and everything. And really, because we had the priorities messed up, and people just always come first. Even when it's a technological solution, people come first because they're the ones who have to embrace it and use it and make it happen. And and manage your culture probably would be the third one, is after recognizing that people are the key, and start asking yourself not just what product we want to make and how we want to make it and how we want to service our customers, but what kind of an organization do we want to be? What do we want to stand for? Whether it be teamwork or family or unity or belonging or making a difference in the world, or anything that captures the hearts and minds of your invaluable workforce, to make it something more than just a product and dollars and cents. Everybody knows it's got to be profitable and it's about dollars and cents, but you have the opportunity to change people's lives in the course of making dollars and cents. So,
you said that on Monday when we had our conversation, and as the listeners will hear in the next interview, which I tape, those are exactly the things that John Sculley, the ex-head of Apple, said were key to success. And I was just struck by it because I had just finished the interview with John. So you and he are on the same wave.
I'm in good company, I guess.
I think so. And I'm glad you repeated them from Monday, because I wanted to give you the compliment. It really struck me because I had just finished the interview with John. And those seem to be the key. And the other one that people always talk about is manage your cash flow. But you've managed to capture almost all of them. He didn't even mention cash flow. But anyway, our listeners will hear that next. Mike, I was really glad you came on the program tonight. I hope our listeners learn something and see the opportunities both for the nation's youth and for themselves in this exploding robotics industry. New York Times just announced that it's creating a new channel called Robotica, Robotica, in which all things robots. So
sweet.
You know that the world of robots is important, because now the New York Times has it as a separate section. So
yeah, there it is. Turn the corner.
Well, it's not of record until the Times says it.
That's right.
So, all right. Mike, we hope you come back again sometime soon and we talk more. And again, mindseyeeducation.com. Did I get it right?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Don. It was a pleasure talking to you.
No, we're so glad you came. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We good?
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Our guest tonight is a real honor for us. It's John Scully. He's a nationally known business person, leader of two great companies, and the author of a new book. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Nice to be with you.
Well, as we ask, always ask all of our guests, we first want to know a little bit about yourself personally before we get into anything else today. Tell us a little bit about yourself, John.
Well, I was born and brought up in New York City, and I lived out on Long Island. I went to university at Brown University and the Rhode Island School of Design. I went on to Wharton Business School, got my MBA, started out in marketing, working with one of the largest marketing advertising agencies in New York City. Actually started working on the Coca-Cola account, doing market research. And then I was recruited to PepsiCo. I was the first MBA that PepsiCo had ever hired. They weren't quite sure what to do with me, so they put me out on a route truck and had me work in bottling plants. And I learned the business getting my hands dirty, which, by the way, is the best advice I can give any entrepreneur. If you want to really understand the business, you got to understand it at the operating level. And then I was at the right place at the right time. I joined Pepsi when it was a very small company. It was actually really a strong regional soft drink brand in the U.S., outsold about 10 to 1 in most of the Southeast and Southwest at that time. We're going back now to 1970, quite some time ago. I was fortunate. I was promoted relatively quickly over about 4 years to become the marketing vice president of Pepsi-Cola. And it was at that time that I worked on such things as the development and launch of the first 2-liter plastic bottle, selling into new channels like mass merchandisers and drug chains that had never carried soft drinks because they didn't like glass bottles because they broke. I helped develop a campaign called the Pepsi Challenge, which enabled Pepsi in markets where we were outsold 10 to 1 to eventually pass Coca-Cola. And I was eventually promoted to become the CEO of Pepsi-Cola Company, and I did that for 5 years. We, by that point, had passed Coca-Cola as the largest selling consumer packaged good in America. And it was because of the work that I did at Pepsi, particularly with the Pepsi Challenge, that Steve Jobs recruited me to come to Apple, because he believed in the early 1980s that technology would eventually become a business that would have to be marketed much the way consumer products like Coke and Pepsi were marketed during the Cola Wars. And his great vision was that personal computers were going to be tools for the mind that would change the way that non-technical people would be able to become both creative and more productive, the so-called knowledge worker era. And I was at Apple from a year before the Macintosh was introduced all the way until Apple became the number one selling personal computer in the world. That was a 10-year run while I was CEO at Apple. We grew from less than $800 million in revenue to over $8 billion in revenue. And I then became an entrepreneur. And I've been an entrepreneur for over 20 years now, helping start companies, mentoring companies. Today, I don't actually run businesses anymore, but I mentor, invest, rainmake, which means open doors, put deals together, in a number of different industry sectors. And it's really in that last era that I've been in for the last 20 years of being an entrepreneur that led me to write a book called Moonshot, because I saw some things that were going on in the world, Don, that are so incredible in terms of the opportunities for small and medium-sized businesses, particularly entrepreneurs, to be able to game change and build transformational companies. And I wanted to tell people about it because I've been lucky to be at the right place at the right time, and I wanted to be able to pass those experiences on to others.
Well, I have to tell you, your book is absolutely fantastic. I read it, still reading it because it's got a lot in it. But for our audience, can you kind of sum up what your main themes are in the book and what you hope that they will get out of it?
Yes, I can. I think of myself, though I've been in high technology now for 32 years, I think of myself as a marketing person. And so I look at technology from the standpoint of, so what are the derivative effects of these incredible technologies? And how do we build businesses around it and take advantage of the technologies? So the biggest change that is happening right now, and it's something that's really unprecedented, is that the rapid growth of several new technologies, not just one, but several, cloud computing, giving us the computational power beyond anything we could have imagined a decade ago. Mobile devices, the smartphone has now surpassed the television as the most important consumer technology in the world. Big data analytics, everything is data today. I grew up in the world of mass marketing. You know, today, if you want to be a marketer, you've got to understand predictive analytics, big data as it's called. And these things are creating a power shift in the marketplace. So it's not the technology that you should focus on so much, it's the effects of the technology. And what it's doing is it's shifting the market power from incumbent companies, often leaders in their industry, companies with great products and reputations, but now along come new companies, and the new companies may have a better product or service. And if they do, customers are now in control, not the producers. And the customers are in control because of the communications we have today, because of the access to information we have today, and the social media, which lets customers listen to the opinions of other customers and to be able to pass on their own opinions. And so customers pay more attention today to the opinions of other customers than they do to the established reputations of even the best incumbents in the industries. And so it's a huge opportunity, and it's also in the book Moonshot, gives pretty good detailed explanation as to why are some of these companies in just a few years, 3, 4, 5 years, becoming so incredibly valuable, and why will this happen again and again, and how you can be a part of it.
Well, that's a fantastic summation. An interesting statistic that I came across my desk on Monday was the fact that still a majority of small businesses still are not embracing this because they seem to be afraid of the technology, afraid of using it. What advice do you give an entrepreneur or a small business as to how to kind of parcel out these changes and apply them to their own business?
Well, I have to reveal here that I am a huge believer that the future of our society in America, our economy, really revolves around how successful we are as a country in terms of making it possible for small and medium-sized businesses to be able to continue to grow. I mean, how do we deal with the increasing regulations? How do we deal with the changing opportunities and the changing competition? And so what it really means is that an entrepreneur, a small and medium business owner or executive, needs to have a broad curiosity. You've got to be interested in what's going on. And what I learned years ago in the years that I was working with MIT at the MIT Media Lab was that you have to be able to see a problem from multiple perspectives. And you don't really understand something, Marvin Minsky, a famous professor at MIT, used to say, unless you see it from more than one perspective. And I think a small and medium business person needs to realize that technologies are commoditizing rapidly, but it's domain expertise in different domains and connecting the dots between these domains. So why did Kodak, for example, miss digital photography? They were the leader in the world, and yet companies that had started in the digital era, like Apple, saw that photography was going to move to the smartphone, and they took advantage of the fact that wireless communications was moving from simple text to the ability to see photos and be able to transmit them over a regular smartphone, and it was Apple who ended up owning the digital photography industry, not Kodak. And so a small and medium business person needs to be well-informed, and they need to have a big curiosity, and they always need to see something, and this is what I try to lay out in pretty much an instructional format in Moonshot, to see the world through the eyes of the customer. Always start with what's in it for the customer. What's the big problem you can solve for the customer? And can you come up with a solution that is better than whatever solutions exist today? If you can, you know, you've got the first principle of, you know, how to build a successful transformational business. Start with a customer problem. And then in Moonshot, Don, I also go through and explain what I call the customer plan. Many people are familiar with the term business plan, and that can be a pretty laborious process, often taking months to put together each year, the annual business plan. But actually, I don't see that much more than just a budget exercise, because it's basically looking backwards and saying, okay, so next year we hope to do a little better, so how will we have the additional money we can generate from doing a little bit better, and how do we allocate it from department to department? That isn't how you build a transformational business. The way you build a transformational business is you have to build a customer plan, not a business plan. And the customer plan says, what does it take to address the big customer problem that hopefully you've identified, and to say, how do I engage customers to, you know, be excited about it? How do I look at the cost of customer acquisition? How do I retain the loyalty of customers once they have come on board? It may astound people to realize that it typically costs 5 to 8 times more to retain a customer than that you may have lost, I should say to replace a customer that you may have lost, than if you had retained that customer in the first place. And so when you start to realize how valuable a business can be when you see it through the eyes of the customer metrics, and when you build a customer plan, it's always about how do you, you know, build a plan that gives you differentiation versus what the other choices are out there for those customers, and leverage the things that you can control, which may be, you know, unique ways to acquire customers, unique ways to build loyalty with customers, unique ways to monetize the customers. And what I reveal in Moonshot are many of the successful strategies that other people have done. Moonshot's not my autobiography. Moonshot is a conversation with entrepreneurs in many different industries about what did they learn, how did they apply it, particularly through this idea of building a customer plan.
Well, in today's world, it's fairly it's a lot easier to reach out to your customers. I really should put that as a question to you. Is it easier today to reach the customer and to better identify the customer than it was,
Absolutely.
Say, 20 years?
Absolutely. If we go back to even during the era that I was CEO of Apple, we didn't have much better information than when I was CEO of Pepsi. We were kind of looking at large categories of demographics, and we didn't know exactly who was going to buy our products or how frequently they may want to continue to look for a product over time. We just didn't have much data. Well, guess what? All of this data is available today, and because of the reliability and the dramatic improvement of not only the power of computers, but the cost of being able to personalize this data down to individuals, this kind of information is available to every company, not just big companies, but it's the small, agile companies that take the time to understand how accessible this kind of information is, how cheap it is to get this kind of information. But the key thing is, how do you put it to work? And how do you commercialize a product, an idea, a marketing campaign in a way that is going to be able to deploy it? So the key insight is not that this is possible or not that there aren't a lot of people with good ideas, but it's all about commercialization and execution. And here's the thing which I found so significant from the most successful entrepreneurs in many different industries that I talk with in putting the book Moonshot together, and that is you never learn from your successes. You always learn from your mistakes. In fact, your successes often cause you to be a victim of your success because you assume that the reason you were successful may or may not have been the reason you were actually successful, and you often become complacent. I mean, why is it that Microsoft and Intel, who dominated the 1990s during the era of the web with personal computers, and yet both of them missed mobility? I mean, how is that possible? I mean, they had very smart people. They had incredible resources, and yet they both missed mobility. So you have to have the perspective of seeing things through the eyes of the customer and then being able to map into that what are the advances in technology that make things that were expensive in one era actually incredibly cheap, and in the case of knowing your customers at a personal level, actually very practical to know exactly who your customer is, exactly what their behavior is, and then being able to take that knowledge and turn it back into a business campaign. And these are the types of things which small and medium business owners and executives are moving to. And I call this being an adaptive innovator. Not everybody needs to be Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Larry Page from Google or Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook. You don't all have to be geniuses to be able to participate in this, but what you have to be is someone who is curious, with an open mind, willing to work hard when you see an opportunity, sense the urgency to be very focused, and you have to be able to learn how to use these new tools that are all about applying data. And so I'm a big believer in being able to use data analytics. Now, I was lucky because I studied math in graduate school, and I come from a marketing background, and I've been working with data my whole business life. So to me, this is like the best time in my life because now the things that we thought of as just academic decades ago suddenly are incredibly practical today. And they're available in various types of services from different technology and other business and marketing cloud companies right now. You don't have to go off and become a mathematician in order to use it.
Well, a question that comes up often when I talk with our audience is the fact that many of these companies that take advantage of all this are really started and run by younger people, and there almost seems to be a generational gap between the younger people in some of these industries and the older people. Do you see that, or do you see innovative people who are of older generations?
Well, I'm older generation, and I still feel pretty innovative. But I don't take for granted that I'm going to be able to do it as well as the younger people. And so you have to be able to tap into the young talent. And anytime anyone worries about America, just get out and go to one of the incubators where these young people are working together. In many cases, four or five companies will resident in a location, and they get to network with one another. But you know what? They love having a mentor. And so for me, I say, gee, I can be a mentor. I can help them commercialize their businesses. I can be a rainmaker. I can open doors. And there are other people like me out there. So you have to say it takes a team to build a company. You know, building a company is a team sport. And you have to figure out when you're putting people on the bus, get them into the right seats. So you don't have to have everybody doing the same thing. It's great having a few gray-haired people on the team who can be able to put into context the experience they have. But you also want some young people on there who are bringing in new talents and have a lot of high energy. So it is a team sport.
It's a very interesting. I've gone to some of these incubators, and you're right about that. It's amazing how they work almost 24/7. Seem to have a whole different approach to the way things are done than certainly my generation, and I think we're somewhat contemporaries. As a final sum up, what would be the three things that if you had to sum up everything you said you would say to our audience?
Well, number one, building a business today, whether it's a business you have and you want to continue to make it successful, or whether you're thinking about even starting a new business, it all starts with the customer. And if you're going to solve a big customer problem, you better have a really good product. I've been fortunate, Don, because I've always worked with companies that built great products. I've never been in the position where I had to sell a mediocre product. I wouldn't honestly know how to sell a mediocre product because I believe that so much of the success has to revolve around getting customers to talk about the products. You know, what do they like about it? So I'm constantly interested in getting customer feedback. So it starts with a big customer problem that has to be identified. You have to create a solution or a product or a service that matches as closely to what you believe is the most exciting way of solving that problem for a customer. And then it's all about getting the right people in your company. It's always about the people. The people are more important. I'm talking about the people in your own company are more important than the ideas. Now, here's the interesting observation I'd make about Silicon Valley. You go out there as a young person, you're valedictorian in your school, you think you're pretty smart, and guess what? You show up and you discover everybody's a valedictorian. There are lots of ideas. There are thousands of good ideas and smart people. So why, if there are so many ideas and smart people, are there only a handful of really successful companies? And the reason is it's all about people. And so you've got to pick the best possible people to work with you. Remember, team sport, build a team, and being able to attract the right people to work together. And then it's all about timing. I mean, you've got to be doing the right thing at the right time. Sometimes you can be too early. Sometimes you can be too late. So it's customers. It's getting the right people. And it's doing the right things at the right time.
Well, the name of your book again and where people can get it?
Yes, the name of the book is Moonshot, How to Create Game-Changing Strategies to Build Billion-Dollar Companies. It's available on Amazon. You can get it as an e-book. You can get it as a hard copy book. You can get it as an audio book. It's designed for people. You don't have to be an engineer to read this book. It's designed for people in business who think about things in an intelligent, common sense way, and who are really interested in building, you know, customer-focused businesses.
Well, a question. Why did you decide to write the book?
I decided to write the book because I've been so lucky in my life to have been in some really interesting places at transformational moments. I've worked with some of the most talented business people in the world over a good number of decades, and I said that I want to pass some of this on. I want people to realize that they can do it too, that there are lessons here that I and others have learned that can be first principles for those who want to go out and build their own businesses and build their own successes. You know, I'm a big believer that America's future revolves around innovation, entrepreneurs, being able to adapt. That's why I call them adaptive innovators, to adapt to the changing opportunities and the incredible tools that we have today, such as mobility and big data analytics, cloud computing, how these things can dramatically change the cost of doing business and the quality of customer experience that we can offer customers. So I wrote it really because I wanted others to be able to enjoy some of the success and fun, really, because I really enjoy doing what I do. That is very much possible today all over the world.
Well, John, thank you for taking your time today to talk with us. If they wanted to reach you or learn more, is there any way they can do you have a website or something?
Sure. Yeah, you can go to John Scully. My website, johnscully.com, that's S-C-U-L-L-E-Y. You can go to Facebook, and you'll see that I use social media, Facebook, Twitter. So you can find me there, also under John Scully. And you can buy Moonshot, and you'll see there's a lot of discussion groups around Moonshot. There are many who are doing blogs around the book. So it's all about getting connected into a network of people who are interested in the same kinds of things you may be interested in. And there's a sweet spot out there, I think, for small and medium-sized businesses.
Well, thank you again, and we hope you'll come back again and talk some more. I've certainly learned a lot today.
Great. Well, I appreciate you inviting me, Don, and I've enjoyed the conversation.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening tonight. All of our guests are invited because they offer actionable advice to our audience. They do not pay to join us, but rather demonstrate their capacity for helping our audience add profits. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here again next week with other experts to talk about ways to improve your profit picture. Remember, we're here every week at blogtalkradio.com/smallbusinessdigest. If you like what you heard today, tell others about our efforts. If you would like to be a guest or suggest topics for future hours, email me at info@smallbusinessdigest.net. That's info@smallbusinessdigest.net. We would also like to remind listeners that besides our radio efforts, Small Business Digest comes to you via the web, through our video channel, and in our magazine. You can subscribe for any or all of these by going to smallbusinessdigest.net. That's smallbusinessdigest.net. Thank you, and have a good day.